Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New in Chess podcast. In the New in Chess podcast, we talk to leading grandmasters, authors, trainers, and other personalities from the fascinating world of chess. The New in Chess podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. DGT is the only brand that provides everything you need to broadcast the games of a chess event, from chess clocks to sensory chess boards. My name is Dirk-Jan ten Geuzendam. My guest in this episode of the New in Chess podcast is Dutch grandmaster Jan Timman. Jan returns to the podcast to talk about his latest book, Timman Studies, an impressive volume of 455 pages in which he presents his collected endgame studies and explains how they originated. Of course, Jan Timman is primarily known as the most successful Dutch chess player of the past 50 years. A world-class player who won countless elite tournaments around the world and rose to second place in the world rankings behind Anatoly Karpov in 1982. However, in recent years, after COVID, Jan's appearances as a player had become significantly less frequent. And a few weeks ago, he announced in an interview with Dutch newspaper Algemeen Dagblad that he has ended his active career as a player. Of course, he still follows chess closely, and he stresses that this is classical chess and not rapid chess, even if Magnus Carlsen plays, and certainly not freestyle chess. Jan also continues to write for New in Chess, but he will no longer seek the tension and excitement of the chess arena. But he will definitely not forgo the pleasure of endgame studies. Jan has been fascinated by endgame studies for most of his chess life, and composing studies gradually became one of his biggest chess passions. As he puts it in our talk, the last 10 years, endgame studies have actually been the most important part of his chess life. In 2011, Jan wrote his first book on endgame studies, The Art of the Endgame, My Journeys in the Magical World of Endgame Studies. And last year, he paid tribute to all the great composers who have inspired him and wrote 100 Endgame Studies You Must Know, some sort of greatest hits from the world of endgame studies of the past century. Beautiful studies composed by greats such as Kasparian, Troitsky, Kubel, Matheson, and Reti, and contemporary giants such as Pervakov and Kralin. And now Jan has written Timman's Studies, my collected endgame studies and their origins. As said, it's a thick book of more than 450 pages, and it contains 186 of his endgame studies composed in a period of more than half a century, between 1971 and 2025. What's more, the final chapter, with 31 studies in total, consists entirely of new work. 1 week before his new book went to press, I interviewed Jan at his home, and it's a true pleasure to share our talk in this podcast. If you're interested in studies and what they mean to Jan, this is certainly a podcast for you. But also recommend you to listen to this episode if you're simply interested in Jan Timman, one of the modern legends of our game. Have fun. Jan, we are here to talk about one of your great passions, studies. And we're going to talk about studies on the occasion of the book that you've all most finished, your Timman's Studies, the collected studies. You've been passionate about studies for a long time. You've written several books already. In the introduction to one of your earlier books, you drew a parallel between the dream worlds that you envisioned as a child and the dream world, or the secluded world of studies. How important has that aspect been for you, that you have this separate world that you're creating, even separate from actually playing in competitions?
Yes, the comparison with dreams is of course not totally correct, because in endgame studies it's very concrete. In dreams, yeah, you have all sorts of unexpected happenings, and endgame studies, everything should be correct. And I think that is the main reason that I'm very much interested in endgame studies from, let's say, a young age. Mm. In chess, you always make mistakes. If you play blitz, you even make more mistakes. And that's annoying. Mm-hmm. So you can find all this beauty all these scientific sides of chess. You can find it in the endgame study.
Yeah, so it's much more than looking for a dream world. It's looking for a pure world.
Yeah, sure, yeah. The dream world is also very interesting, and I have been dreaming a lot over the years, and I write down my dreams. I can just publish all books, all sorts of books about it. I have written a lot of essays that are unpublished about dreams, and I can go on, but I never published anything. And on Endgame Studies, I have published, of course, my books.
You've published extensively about your studies. So if we're talking about this purity, then, for me, it's tempting to see a connection to your father's profession, who was a mathematician, a professor. And in fact, this search for truth, which you already had in analyzing your games, I mean, the art of analysis, is that something that may be derived from him?
It's quite possible. Yeah, he was of course a professor in applied mathematics, not in pure mathematics, but applied mathematics. But he was always busy there, and he has done a lot for science in general. Yeah. And I think that he would have appreciated it to see these books. But unfortunately, he died in 1975, that's half a century ago.
Yeah. When he was hoping that you would go for an academic career, was he hoping that you would go into mathematics or?
Yeah, sure. He was aiming for that, basically, from a young age. He always had some plans for his children, what they should do.
Uh-huh.
And it was beyond doubt that he wanted me to become a mathematician.
Were you good at mathematics in school?
Yes, I was quite good at it. And already at primary school, I was very good at calculations. And I think that in general helped me a lot. It's very sharp calculations and excellent memory.
Yeah. And do you see this connection, I mean, between your passion for studies and a talent for mathematics?
Probably it's linked, yeah. My father considered chess to be some, let's say, part of mathematics, just a whole field of mathematics, and just a specific field with certain rules.
Mm-hmm.
And so this actually fits in. The endgame study fits in much better in that idea than just practical games.
Yes. And he needed some confirmation of the correctness of your choice to become a professional chess player. And I remember he had a talk with Max Oeber, who was also a mathematician. Was he able to reassure him that you were taking the correct step?
Well, I'm not sure that he was talking with Oeber much about that. He knew Oeber quite well from the Mathematics Centrum in Amsterdam.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in meetings with Oeber from that point of view. I think that he had a talk with Paul Keres once. Paul Keres gave a seminar in Delft and against all the professors there. And my father played, and actually he lost the game. And then he had a talk with Keres afterwards. And Keres told him that actually his brother, who was a mathematician, was much happier than he was, and his life was not so easy. And my father thought that for that reason, it was better for me not to become a chess player. He just emphasized that I would be staying in some hotels all the time and it would be a difficult life. But in fact, I liked that sort of life, to stay in hotels, just to live my own life and not to get up early.
Yeah. Well, how did, let's say Max Oeber, the first and so far only Dutch world champion, he was very fond of you as a chess player and as a person, I got the impression. How did he look at that? Did he think that he should warn you for what you were going to do? Did he perhaps think, okay, he's from an academic background, maybe he should go and study? What did he say to you?
No, I think at that time he understood that times were changing. And that people didn't really aim for a career, young people. And so let's say in the late 60s, the idea that you would aim for a career was something ludicrous. Most people just wanted to live their life.
Yeah, but he was a very disciplined and old-fashioned, let's say, from the older days.
But he looked around and he saw what young people were like. And so he was actually, let's say, well aware of society.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I remember when my father died, I had a talk with him at his home in Buitenveldert. And at that time, I just had some silly idea that I should still do mathematics.
Oh, really?
And he encouraged that.
Uh-huh.
But on the other hand, never anything came of that, of course.
Yeah. But was that more an expression of your love for your father than a realistic thought?
Yes, expression of love for my father and grief, of course, as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So, as far as I remember, you've always been interested in endgame studies. But of course, first and foremost, you were an active player with a rich career, and there was not that much time for studies. What kind of role did it play for you in, let's say, the peak of your career? There was something like 2 decades that you really were in the top of the world, playing for the world championship. What role did it play at the time?
I think that it played a role when I didn't do well. Of course, I had weak periods in my playing career, and then I would devote some time to endgame studies. And that's basically the role. But then, of course, I had to play again, and I just forgot it. But the role the studies played became much stronger when the computers became stronger, because that made it much easier to check all the possibilities. And that made it possible that I could compose much more complicated studies.
Yes, but then let's say now we're already talking about your own compositions. But what I remember from when I started working for Neumann Chess, and at some point I began to visit your home and being in your library, I remember the pride with which you pointed out all the study composers that you had the books by, and many of those people I'd never heard of, but it was clear that they played a very important role for you. Was that pure inspiration or?
Yeah. Yes, well, inspiration, sure, but I was very impressed by these people, by Kubel, by Troitsky, by Kasparyan, just to name a few. And they have also written excellent books, also Gurvich and others, too many to mention, actually. But especially Kasparyan's books were very interesting. Kubel has a book with 150 of his endgame studies. Mm. When I was writing my book about my best collected studies, I thought about the idea of also selecting 150, like Kubel.
Uh-huh.
But then I thought, well, there are more. So it became 181. And now I'm not very satisfied because I'm considering to make more studies and what to do when the book is there.
Yeah.
It's always a problem.
But it's always interesting to have, a fairly typical number.
Yes.
I mean, I remember these books by, was it Lommer who had all these numbers?
Oh, yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
Yes, and then,
I think that was the peak of his career.
4, 5, 6, 7.
Yeah.
Yes. That, and, of course, you have Troitsky, the 500 endgame studies.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because what I was wondering when you showed me those books by study composers, that most of them they were in Russian, so you very much were you had to depend on the moves. I mean, the beauty of the studies were purely shown by the moves. Was that enough, or did you try to find out more about these?
My Russian is of course. Insufficient to understand everything, but I understand a lot when I read about chess. Mm-hmm. A lot of chess terms I'm familiar with, and I can, of course, read the letters. So so there was a more than just the moves, sure.
But there is, let's say, compared to chess games where there's always psychological backgrounds, there's situations in tournaments. In that sense, studies are very pure. And but at the same time, you would love to be there. Background stories of why something was composed, or
But when I actually was writing about my studies, sometimes I thought it was a bit difficult to vary a lot in the descriptions of moves, because you always come to the same expressions. But then I thought it's not really very important. People should just enjoy reading it and just go through the studies and get some explanation that should be sufficient.
Yes. Well, but at the same time, what I always liked in your game collections was that you would have a small introduction to a game. It says, well, I was in a second-hand bookshop in Milan, and there I ran into Robert Huebner, and we talked about, I don't know. I mean, I'm partly making this up, but I think there is some introduction that goes a bit like this. And I saw in one of your study collections that you said, okay, I was in a hotel in Antwerp and I was thinking of how I could compose a study, and then with a certain
theme. Yes, that is true.
And I mean, it's that kind of thing that the romanticism of that I always felt attracted to.
Yes.
It's nice to say I read a book, but it's even nicer to say I read a book while I was on a holiday in Greece.
Yes, that's actually true. You can find studies that were composed during holidays in two Greek islands, and one on Paros, and one study from Paros, and Zakynthos.
Uh-huh.
And also I have composed studies in Corralejo, Fuerteventura.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also wrote part of my book on Mulisch there.
The Dutch author.
2012,
But that was purely about literary
themes.
Yes,
that was not related to chess, no.
No. So at some point you started to compose yourself. Do you remember, was it a natural process? How did that develop?
Yeah, just some ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, I think, 1971. So it's a long time ago that I got some ideas. But I didn't really have very good compositions in these early years, let's say in the 70s. You can see it in my book that the first chapter is studies from the last century, but there are not so many. And you see the increasing amount of studies in the most recent years. And new studies, of course. You see that in this book, in the last chapter, the seventh chapter, you see 30 completely unpublished studies.
Mm. Well, that's what struck me when you published the Art of the Endgame, which you wrote in an outburst of creativity that lasted, what was it, 7 or 8 or 9 months, and it was almost like you have a rock band and they go to an island for several months because they want to make a new album. And they are just astonished by the inspiration they get there. Well, was it something like that? I mean, you write about it as if it even surprised you. That
well, the point is that at that time, so that it came out when I was 60, I had just discovered the computer and all the possibilities. So I was very enthusiastic to publish all these findings. But when I look back now, I think that the book is still, it's a very fine book, and I'm very happy with it. But I couldn't really take too many studies out of that book for my new collection because I considered some of them not good enough. And also I saw possibilities to improve on studies, to make them more economical, so fewer pieces, and to make them better just.
Yeah.
And I'm still busy with that because actually 2 days ago, I sent a new study to Peter Bull, which is an improvement on one study that I had sent and that got a prize in the tournament. because it's better.
Yeah.
And so I've improved on a lot of studies. And actually, you should realize it is not only endgame studies.
Mm.
Some studies you will see are just middle game positions that just evolve. And finally, you will see in endgame a lot of things are happening. Some of the studies are really like some sort of adventure where the composer takes you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also what I liked about the old composers like Caspar Jan. They took you to an adventure.
Mm-hmm. How should I say that? So they start from a certain theme, or they start from... I mean, if I'm thinking about this rock band, go to this island, so one song will start with a guitar riff, the other will start with... I mean, somebody comes up with some lyrics. Is it that way that you're just, fishing for ideas or themes that...
Yeah, it's hard to say. Yeah, sometimes I just look through the database and I just look for ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I see an old study and I think, this idea is good, but you can distill a better idea out of it. And that's actually what I have done. Also, I have actually two files of... Just basically one file now, with improvements on old studies. I have sent them to Jacob Augert, who's preparing a book, I think, with Karsten Müller.
Yeah.
At Endgames, and he wants to use that material.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that also you save part of culture if you just improve old ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And when, I wrote this book, The 100 Endgame Studies You Must Know, that was a very hard task, because actually... It would be much better to have 200 endgame studies, you must know.
Why is that?
Because I had to leave out a lot of my favorite studies, because there was no way I could include them.
I mean, that book is written in a very inviting manner to the reader. So you start with seemingly simple studies, and it becomes more and more complicated. Do you think that there were too many difficult ones that were left out, or
no? It's just I had to make a choice, and that was not always easy. I just had to make a choice. What's let's say important in endgame studies? That was sometimes a very hard choice.
Mm-hmm.
It was, for example, one study of Kubel that I really enjoyed, but I thought, I enjoy it, but maybe it's not good enough.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. At DGT, we want to bring people together and help them grow through play by supporting chess and creating innovative, high-quality products for players everywhere. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
And let's say many of those composers, they are not well known to the average chess player. How much do we know about composers of chess? Let's say someone like Kubel. Do they have generally known life stories like we know the stories of the best chess players?
Well, no, not really. No, you don't get too much out of it. I mean, in the old Soviet Union, for example, about Kubel, Leonid Kubel, that he was not the only Kubel, and also a brother, but he was the famous Kubel.
Mm.
We know from Alexander Herbstmann that he died in the siege of Leningrad.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, Alexander Herbstmann took the last train out of Leningrad, escaped from the siege, and he wanted Kubel to join him, but Kubel didn't want to leave Leningrad.
Amen.
And that was a very sad story, actually.
Mm-hmm. And Herbstmann, he wrote a famous anthology of studies.
Herbstmann, actually, he escaped. And later he just lived till he was old, of course. And he's also famous for his books,
yeah. Because that's, of course, it's also my fault that I'm not very familiar with this world. So, but the kind of stories that you long for, I remember Hein Donner writing about Troitsky, and then he was imagining him sitting somewhere in the woods, surrounded by wolves. And
that was actually Tim Cabet's story.
Made that up.
Yeah.
But was that fiction or was that based on anything?
Yeah, it was not total fiction. It was known that Alexei Troitsky was just staying in the woods. Yeah, how do you call this? Woudopzichter.
Forester. He was a forester, yeah.
Yeah, forester, yeah. Correct. Yeah, he was a forester, yeah.
So that was Tim Corbet's story, yeah.
Yeah, that was Tim's story, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, yes, and Troitsky, he was a forester, and that left him with a lot of time to...
Yes.
Yeah. Who are your absolute favorites in study composing?
Well, I think that's Caspar Jan is the one name that comes first, and I like Kubel very much. I like Pervakov, of course. Yeah. Kralin is very good. He's still alive. So Pervakov and Kralin are still alive. I think they're both very good. I have only one study of Kralin, but it was very difficult to include more studies. And Matheson is of course a great composer.
He was from Lithuania, right?
He was Latvia.
Latvia.
And Nadarashvili from Georgia. And Gurgenitsa, David Gurgenitsa.
Yeah. But maybe that's what I'm trying to do, is to get some pictures of the people. So Troitsky, for me, is sitting in the woods with the wolves around him. I remember the first time I saw Oleg Pervakov was when I went to Moscow and visited the office of 64, the Russian magazine. And Alexander Rochal, he was still the editor, legendary editor. And he showed me around the premises there. And then he pointed at the door, and I looked inside, and Oleg Pervakov was sitting there. And we walked, and we continued. And then Rochal, he said, "Genius."
Yeah.
And I could see that he was not joking at all, that he seriously meant, this guy is a genius.
Yes, he's basically a full-time study composer.
Yeah, but I was looking at one of his studies in one of your books, but that's serious stuff. I mean,
very good, yes.
Yeah.
I forgot actually one more, Abram Gurevich is a very good composer. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. He was a critic of literature and theater play.
Ah, okay.
That was his profession. Actually, Nadarashvili, that I mentioned, Gian Nadarashvili, was a doctor and physical doctor. Mm. He was very good friends with Botvinnik.
Uh-huh.
So when I got the book that he signed for me personally, I got it from Botvinnik.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 1988.
That's a good provenance.
Yeah.
Yeah. And did you have any idea if Botvinnik was interested in studies?
Or? Yes, he made some Eindgame studies, yeah.
Uh-huh.
He made already in 19... when he was very young, yeah. He made together with one study composer an Eindgame study. And he has made six Eindgame studies. He writes about it.
Mm-hmm.
In the last chapter of one of his books, he has a chapter, My Eindgame Studies.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and of course, Smyslov, he was the one who at some point started to compose an awful lot.
Yeah, especially when he was blind, he could still compose.
Mm-hmm.
His first study was from the age of 15, and a beautiful study, beautiful idea.
Mm-hmm.
And he composed a study, I think, in 1976. But he became actually very enthusiastic about endgame studies later in his life.
Mm-hmm.
Although he was, of course, he couldn't see, and that is very interesting that he could still imagine these positions. One of his studies I noticed was actually completely just anticipated by Gorgiev.
That it, the idea had been used before?
Yes, it was completely the same as a study by Gorgiev, but he didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, of course, it's a bit difficult if you cannot read.
Yeah.
And he, of course, he couldn't use a computer, so that was actually very impressive what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Benke, Paul Benke was a very good composer, and I have also included his studies in the Book of Hand and Endgame Studies.
Yeah, let's say if we're looking at the really strong players who were good composers, then it's so Smyslov, Benke, you.
Réti, of course.
Réti.
Yeah, Réti is, of course, I should also mention Richard Réti was an excellent composer and some very important ideas in the Endgame study.
Yeah, yeah, well, his famous study is probably the
It starts in my book. Starts with the pawn endgame, the Réti maneuver. Yeah.
Because it's I think you cannot show that to someone who doesn't like it.
Yeah, though that is actually the start of enjoying endgame compositions. That's why I took it as my first study in the book.
And is it more difficult to enjoy more complicated studies? Because let's say I saw one of Perfekov's studies where you explained that in fact it was three phases.
Yes, that is I think the last study in the book. Yes, I kept that for the end. And yes, that is of course more difficult. But you see, the study by Réti, that is just, it's like an optical illusion.
Yes.
You see, that is impossible. That's why it makes it well.
Yeah.
But some studies by Perfekov and also my own studies, they have such a degree of difficulty that you need very good explanation just to really appreciate it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is true, yeah. Some of the studies by Perfekov, yes, are very impressive, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. No, but that's why it's always, let's say with your studies, it's always so important to have the explanations, what it's about and which stages of the plan are executed. And because, let's say, if you give me a study and you say, okay, white to move and win, that's not enough. I mean, you have to know.
Yes, of course, yeah. And of course, it's difficult to make to compose studies. That's why there are so few study composers.
Yeah.
Because I talked, for example, Erwin Lamy asked me this question: How do you do it?
Yeah,
and it's hard to explain.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, basically, most study composers, also Perfekov, just start with the end, and then you go backwards, which you call retrograde thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So you always have to wonder. You have let's say the ideas at the end.
Mm.
It's not always like that. But there are some studies where you just work towards the end, but you have somewhere in the middle. You have something beautiful.
Yeah.
But in many cases, it's the final position or near the final position, and then you think, there's something really really beautiful here. But how do I get there? Now you have to think, what was Black's last move? What was White's last move? And there you go, just back. And of course, in general, of course, if you play chess, you will think forward.
Mm-hmm.
You just think, what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. But this way of thinking also is very very nice. It is something that attracted me very much already at a young age. How do you think that way?
Mm-hmm.
And that's something why I like endgame studies very much, because you can see these ideas developing backwards.
But you have to have a special talent to think backwards.
Not only that, also you have to, for example nowadays, to see the differences in certain positions. For example, I have a position. And then I see there's a lot of pieces on the board, but there's, let's say, a black pawn is on h6.
Mm-hmm.
Now I wonder, should it be on h6? How about if it's on h7? And then you see completely different judgments by the computer. You think it's different variations.
Mm-hmm.
And then that is very interesting, you think, Bill. What can be the difference? And you see some very fine variations. After 6-7 moves, you see, now I see the difference. Yeah, but the difference it makes in this specific variation, which is not important otherwise. And that is fascinating.
Yeah. So you, how difficult is it to compose without a board? I mean, because you describe, as I said, okay, I'm in a hotel in Antwerp and I was thinking of composing something with a certain theme. Then how do you start to think about that?
Well, in the former days, of course, I had a physical chessboard on the table. But nowadays I don't do that. Of course, I have just in my computer the screen.
But are there studies that you thought up just without a board, just in your mind, or is it too difficult?
Yes, of course, yeah.
Or is it then mainly the idea?
But of course, then I need the computer to improve on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And to see what's possible. Let's say, of course, there's sometimes... one thing is, I shouldn't think of study ideas late in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife, Geertje, also tells me, no, not after 11 o'clock. You're not allowed to think about endgame stuff.
Because it will ruin your sleep.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Because then you will think, maybe it's 3 o'clock, let's say. Oh, now I understand how I can improve it. And that is, of course, not desirable because you don't sleep.
Or you get into weird dreams where these studies pop up.
Not really. No, I think not. No. Actually, I very recently I read the poems by Borges. He said also that he had problems to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that. Actually, he writes in just, it's not really a poem, but just a story, but it's included in his poems. And then he just says, well, I do these exercises with my breathing, but it doesn't help. You lie awake for hours think about things. So I thought, well, yeah, he also had that problem.
Yeah. Well, often it is said that, solving endgame studies or enjoying them, that it also helps your practical play. What I remember from when you were playing in tournaments and you would be at a tournament and then somebody has, for instance, you want to show a study or somebody else wants to show a study. And then I was always amazed by the great interest of the other grandmasters. There were hardly any of them who said, not for me. No, they wanted to see. And almost always they grew enthusiastic.
Yes.
And I often wondered, I mean, was that because they were so difficult or because they liked the beauty? You could see, okay, here we are amongst ourselves talking. I mean, this is the pure beauty that we all enjoy without exception. Is it that? I mean,
yes, of course, because let's say you take a game and you see a brilliant combination, for example.
Yeah.
Now, this it's published everywhere. You know, brilliant move by Marshall and gold coins.
Yeah.
Now, okay, but you see in the endgame still, you see the real essence of all this beauty.
Yeah.
Without all these pieces that have nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
And that's why I think that grandmasters like it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's becoming more beautiful. You understand that there's a hidden beauty in chess. And of course, these grandmasters would never get excited about a problem or a helpmate because that makes absolutely no sense. I never looked at a helpmate, for example.
No.
Mate in two sometimes, you have a glimpse and then you think, well, okay, this is mate in two. And if it's complicated, then you don't look at it.
Yeah, so in fact, for you, it always was connected to the deeper layers of your play.
Yes, I think it's really chess. Yeah, basically, that's also what I explain in the foreword of my book, that the study composers are very busy with themes. They want to see specific theme, and that it should be worked out in a specific way that is original or whatever. Now, okay, a chess grandmaster looks at it and thinks, well, okay, that may be a specific theme, but it's quite obvious what is happening. So what's special about it?
Yeah.
Well, in fact, when I make a study and I think, well, this is really something interesting, and grandmasters would, of course, appreciate it, but study composer says, ah, annoying line, not the play is not very very interesting, and there's a lot of turmoil. But that is just chess, actually. That is what they overlooked. That it is chess, but what I show.
Can you be a good study composer and without being a very strong player?
There are some examples, not so many. I mean, most. Of the people I knew were excellent players, like Kaspar Jan and
Matteson. I was wondering, well, how strong was Kaspar Jan as a player?
Well, he played in the Soviet Championship, and he made the draws against very strong grandmasters, like I don't know exactly, Bronstein maybe. I don't know. I have also a book about his his games, and he was an excellent player. The strongest is probably Matteson. Yes, he beat Aljakain, and he died young, but before before he died, he actually had some really great results. You can read it in the end games.
I should read something more about Kaspar Jan, because it's funny that there's only one photo I know of him, and then my first thought is, in which office was he working? But apparently, well, he made all these beautiful studies, so there must be more to Kaspar Jan than that.
Yes, of course, yeah.
What kind of work did he do? Do you have any idea?
Kaspar Jan, I don't know what he did. I never...
He was...
I think that he was very much busy with chess, like Korolkov, for example. I forgot to mention Korolkov and Bronn. Also very good composers. But Kaspar Jan, actually, he once, when I was in Budapest, Laszlo Polgár showed me a booklet where he had written down with these old diagrams and on one side and handwritten the solutions. And this booklet, I was very interested, but Laszlo, he actually wanted to sell me a whole apartment in Budapest.
Right.
With a lot of books in it.
Okay.
For $80,000. But at that time I thought, well, what to do with it?
apartment came with the books.
Yes, but then he showed me that book and I thought, well, no, the apartment, okay, forget about the apartment, but okay, this booklet. And he said, no, I don't sell this.
No.
So that was really a pity.
But that was by Kaspar Jan.
Yes, that was Kaspar Jan's own.
You love chess. Why don't you try New in Chess? With readers in 116 countries, New in Chess is the premier chess magazine in the world. What will you get? Exciting chess games explained by the best experts in a clear and accessible way, on-the-spot reports of the biggest events, top-notch instruction, independent journalism, chess history that comes to life, and great interviews. New in Chess, the way you want it. The beautifully produced paper edition, or the digital edition for phone, tablet, or PC. Give it a try. Go to our website, newinchess.com/magazine, for more information about subscriptions and special offers.
And Kurt Groykov has a book on Kaspar Jan studies, complete.
So that's separate from his test tube chess.
Yes, sure.
Yeah.
A better book, yeah.
Yeah, because that's why you're mentioning Roycroft, who was the editor of EG for a long time, and whenever I saw EG, which is a magazine on endgame studies, it looks like a very esoteric world. I mean, there's very little in the manner of illustrations or. I mean, it's just positions and moves.
Yes.
did that ever, I mean, it apparently it never disturbed you. I mean, for you, you could see through that. But do you think that the popularity of endgame studies could be improved if it was...
Yes, of course.
A bit more lavish. Or?
Yeah, then you should do something else, yeah, if you want to improve the popularity. But this is just a magazine for the connoisseurs, of course, yeah.
But is that, let's say, the... It is... You get the feeling that it is a bit of a closed world, which is a pity, because there's so many people who, once they, like you do, you show in your books that it's worth entering that that world. Have you gotten a lot of response to that, of people saying, "Well, I'm happy that you opened this door for us"?
Well, yes. Some people tell me that. Not so many. I don't see so many people, but that's true. But on the other hand, I think that is important. But you should also realize there are not so many people who can do it, who can make and compose endgame studies. So, so this world is always a bit limited. People can just look at it. You have no competition element, so that disappears, and people always want to see a competition, and you don't see it.
Yeah, was it? I mean, for you, has it always been an integral part of your chess life, or
not always? No, just
or just a satellite life.
But let's say the last 10 years, it's actually. Most important part of my chess life. I don't follow rapid tournaments. Also, not if Magnus Carlsen plays. I don't follow freestyle. I follow the classical tournaments.
Yeah,
that's all. But I still prefer just to look at endgame studies.
Yeah. So it's this, let's say, the old master who goes into purity more and more.
Yes. True. Yeah.
Yeah. But at the same time, we've also seen artists like Beethoven who became extremely modern in their later years.
Yes. Although he didn't become very old, no.
No. That is true.
Yeah.
So the purity that... How does that compare to let's say you've been evaluating your games when you wrote Timon's Triumphs. Which in fact gave you a different perspective on your games, because you made an entirely different selection compared to your previous best game collection. How is evaluating your study composing history? I mean, what did you draw different conclusions there? I mean, did you see how yourself? How your style changed, or
yes, of course, yeah. I see that the studies become more complicated. The more the stronger computers are, and more complicated studies you can make.
Yes,
and the old studies sometimes complicated, but not always. I mean, I think that they're partly quite good, but. But I see that, some study composers like Pavlikov make very good use of the computer. And he's still very good. Also, who's making very good use of the computer is Stefan Slumstrup-Nielsen. And Martin Minsky is also very good.
Okay.
From Germany.
Yeah.
And Nielsen is from Denmark.
There must be inevitably developments in study composing endgame composing. Are they inevitably becoming more complicated, or is there still room for, let's say, fairly simple purity?
Yes, also. Yeah. Well, you can see that I have also made some rather simple endgame studies recently, but the majority is more complicated. Just complicated ideas and beautiful ideas that you discover by working with the computer. Sometimes you look at the position and you see some very unexpected move in the position, you see what's going on. And then you try to connect it with your main idea, and then you come to some fascinating results.
Well, let's say if I look at myself, when I go through a book with studies, then I'm looking for these beautiful maneuvers, these surprising twists and turns. I never sit down and try to solve a study, which probably is something that goes for many people. Or are there people who really yes. sit down to solve it?
Some people do that, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't do it.
No.
I don't try to solve compositions.
Mm.
Of course, with problems, it's something different. But but when I see a study, I just want to know immediately what it's like.
Mm-hmm.
But what is good about the books that I write now also, that there are a lot of diagrams. So mm-hmm. that basically means
yeah.
that you don't need a chessboard
mm-hmm.
to follow it.
Yeah.
Of course, the chessboard, if you really relaxed and you want to have a chessboard, mm-hmm. you should do it.
Yeah.
But you can do it also on the train. You can enjoy the studies.
Yeah. Yeah. And for you, I mean, your readers, they are allowed to enjoy it without setting themselves the task to solve them.
Yes, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because that's an entirely different world, the problem-solving competitions.
Oh, yes. Problem-solving and also endgame study solving.
Yeah.
Yes. There are championships in that.
Yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't really interest
you. You never took part
in
that.
For example, John Nunn is quite good at it. Mestel.
Yeah.
Jonathan Mestel.
Yeah. But you never took part in
those. No.
Well, it's a world of incredible beauty, Jan. And, I mean, I haven't played through all of them, but the ones that I played through or had a look at, I mean, they're very inspirational and they open vistas.
Yes, you still have to need time to go through the others.
Yeah. And for you, I mean, is it a selling point that it helps you in your active chess, or should people not worry about that?
No, I don't know.
No.
It's just I just do whatever I like to do. Yeah,
yeah. No. I mean, for people who want to enjoy it, I mean, just enjoy the beauty. And, okay, maybe it's not...
Yeah, people should enjoy it. Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm mm-hmm. hoping that they do. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It would open new worlds for them. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I remember when Judith Polgar was promoting her chess composing competition during the festival in honor of Paul Benkert, and she said, well, and it makes you a better player, which I think, okay, maybe, I mean, it will not damage your play, but...
I'm not sure, yeah. It's hard to say.
Yeah.
But you should realize that I encouraged Judith to start doing this.
Oh, really, yeah?
Yeah, during this Levitov event in 2019.
Ah.
I told her, well, Judith, why don't you do this?
And yeah.
She liked the idea.
Okay, very good. Yeah. Because well, when you were you've been training with her years back. Well, were you looking at studies then as well?
No, not really. We just looked at openings.
Yeah. Because the let's say the Polka sisters, when they grew up, those were mostly let's say positions that they had to solve. That they were not really studies, right?
No, just simple positions. What do you do here? Just simple combinations and that sort of stuff.
But I think all of them, they developed an interest in endgame studies as well, right?
Yes, that is true. Yeah, mostly you did. Yeah.
Also because probably their close connection with Paul Benker and...
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So... No, thanks for a beautiful book, Jan, and for your insights in this.
That's all right. It's a pleasure. Yeah, it's my pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. To leave a comment, go to our socials or email us directly at podcast@newinchess.com. If you'd like to buy Jan Timman's great new book, Timman's Studies, or his previous bestseller, Endgame Studies, 100 Endgame Studies You Must Know, please visit the webshop on our website, newinchess.com. There you will find a wide selection of fine books and all the details how to easily order them. And this is also the place to subscribe to New in Chess magazine, the magazine that has readers in 116 countries around the world. We thank our sponsors at DGT for their support, and hope to have you back for the next episode of the New in Chess podcast.